Well, it definitely is a huge hit to our yearly income. Kings generate the lion's share of economy for us as guides.
King salmon closures take a toll on tourism. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 2nd of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the star of one of the world's most extreme running events prepares to defend her title.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure, but then you just have to pipe down and kind of... I'm not going to be kicked out of town if I don't win.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's land of a midnight sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
A controversial idea to swap land between the Interior Native Regional Corporation Doyon Limited and the federal government is unlikely to move forward. The environmental impact statement released by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service today recommends against the exchange. The proposal was to swap 110,000 acres of the Yukon Flats National Wildlife Refuge that were believed to contain oil and gas prospects for a minimum of 150,000 acres of Doyon land, including land the corporation owns that lies within the boundaries of the refuge. Doyon also wanted rights to develop oil and gas on another 97,000 acres adjacent to the refuge. Fish and Wildlife spokesman Bruce Woods says the no-swap preferred alternative was a direct result of geologic research through the EIS process.
Both in response to or in investigation of substantive comments from the public and in other research that was part of the EIS process, it led us to this decision.
Wood says the public input was extensive.
There were more than 100,000 public comments that came in, which is, you know, a pretty big number for the service up here in Alaska. I think the only thing we've done since I've been here that got more public response was the polar bear listing.
Wood says most comments were in opposition to the exchange because of concerns over impacts to subsistence resources. Doyon Vice President for Lands and Natural Resources Jim Murray says after the U.S. Geological Survey work, the corporation was surprised to learn that the land proposed for the swap may not hold as much promise as land Doyon now owns. He says the preferred alternative proposed is not a disappointment.
I think had they moved towards a decision for one of the exchange alternatives, given all the changes to the fundamentals of why we went into this in the first place, I think we would have struggled to go forward.
Murray says it's not likely that a different land swap will be proposed.
What we see now is several new substantial prospects on Doyon lands that we own today, including lands that are only 30 miles from the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. And we believe that some of the work that the USGS has done has actually downgraded some of the federal prospects that we were interested in acquiring.
Murray says there is potential near Birch Creek, Stevens Village, and Beaver.
Our intention right now is to focus on developing our own lands in the Yukon Flats in close coordination with communities there that have expressed strong interest in working with us.
Murray says Doyon is in discussions with oil and gas industry officials, but he declined to say which companies they were working with. The Athabascan village of Birch Creek is the closest community to the proposed swap area, about 200 miles north of Fairbanks. Village Chief Operating Officer Angela Ludwig says the village has 200 tribal members, but only about 30 people live there currently because there is no work. She says they overwhelmingly support oil and gas development, and although they were a bit disappointed in the decision against the swap, they're excited about the future prospects for Doyon and Birch Creek corporate land development.
We strongly believe that the native lands can be used for both traditional uses and economic development. We think the technology is good enough and that we'd be involved enough that we would play a strong role in seeing that happen.
The final environmental impact statement will likely be published in December, with a final record of decision coming 30 days later. Sport fishing for king salmon is closed this holiday weekend in many of the most popular fishing creeks in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. The closure notice comes on the heels of an earlier emergency order shutting down the Deska River to king salmon anglers due to poor escapement. As APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports, fishing guides are taking the shutdown hard.
No fishing signs are up on the Little Susitna River, effective early Friday morning. Sam Ivey, assistant area management biologist for Northern Cook Inlet, says the kings are just not coming back.
What we're seeing is a downturn here later in the season on some of these streams. The Little Susitna River in particular had been tracking very closely to last year in 08 when we had a weak run, and we made the escapement goal this past year, and we were expecting to meet that again. This past Friday, the Little Sioux took a downturn. Fishing success was very poor, and so we needed to take action.
Helicopter flights over the river systems have confirmed that few kings are making their way up the creek. The emergency order also closes weekend fishing on the easily accessible park's highway fishing sites, Sheep, Montana, and Willow Creeks.
Fishing success has been slow out there the last couple of weekends. This past weekend should have been, historically, the peak weekend of fishing. Fishing success was poor overall.
He says the emergency orders affect Unit 2 rivers only. The Talkeetna, Chulitna, and Yentna rivers further north remain open to king anglers. The king fishing season was scheduled to end on July 13th, and this upcoming holiday weekend was to be the last Parks Highway weekend fishery the Department of Fish and Game had planned for the king season. But the kings are not moving according to the calendar, and nobody knows that better than Little Susitna guide Andy Couch, who operates Fishtail Guides in Palmer.
All those closures are the streams that I guide on. As far as the king salmon trips, you know, that's all that I've scheduled through the 13th there. We'll be refunding 100% of people's money if that's what they want. If there's an opportunity to take them for something else and they would like to do it, I would be happy to do that. But I have not seen any silver salmon or chum salmon yet.
Couch says most clients are canceling, a few rescheduling for later in the summer. Couch is providing 100% refunds for disappointed clients. Could silver salmon provide a silver lining? Couch says it's too early to see silvers, and a look at commercial fishing records indicate it will be a while.
Only 29 silvers have been taken so far Monday out in the drift fishery in the central district of Cook Inlet, and they still have to come to the northern district before they get to the Matsu streams, so I don't think there's hardly any silver salmon in the streams yet.
Couch is taking the closures philosophically.
I think everybody should hope to benefit in the future from the positive aspect of getting escapement and future production.
But Pat Donaldson, owner of iFish Alaska Guide Service in Wasilla, says it's a downer.
Well, it definitely is a huge hit to our yearly income. King season's the big draw here to the valley. Kings definitely generate the lion's share of economy for us as guides in the local area. And so losing our last couple of weeks of king fishing is definitely going to hurt us.
Donaldson, too, is issuing refunds.
But all the local rivers that I fish are closed now, so basically it shuts my business down, so I'm giving refunds to all the charters that I have between now and the end of king season on July 13th.
And he says a good silver season could turn things around for his business, but Donaldson blames the State Board of Fisheries for the king shortage.
I'm really hoping that this brings some attention and points a spotlight on the management policies for Upper Cook Inlet, because those have had a huge impact on us for a lot of years now, and now it's finally turned into a crisis.
He says Matsu sport fishermen have fought for a greater share of salmon in northern Cook Inlet river systems for years, but have lost allocation squabbles to the inlet's commercial fishermen. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Flint Hills North Pole refinery is operating closer to normal capacity. The refinery has restored operation of a crude oil processing unit it took offline in March. The move was in reaction to a decline in demand for jet fuel due to the seasonal drop in air traffic made worse by the recession and the eruption of Mount Redoubt, which forced diversion of flights from Alaska. Flint Hills spokesman Jeff Cook says things have turned around to some degree.
Our jet fuel now compared to when we closed down the crude unit 3 on March 7th is about close to double what it was. We're still not up to the levels that we've had in the past, but a lot of the diversion of traffic from the volcanoes back through Anchorage. And then you've got your seasonal uptick with airlines like Condor coming in and out, and then the domestic carriers adding more flights for the summer tourist season to accommodate all the tourists coming in and out. So it's not back where we'd like it, but it's a whole lot better than it was a couple months ago.
Cook says the refinery's third processing unit was brought back online in May. Meanwhile, Flint Hills continues to consider the refinery's overall future. The operation has struggled economically, in part due to a premium it pays the state under a long-term contract for North Slope royalty oil. But Cook says relatively low oil prices have eased the situation.
With the price of crude down and our cost of our fuel is down, so it certainly improves the economics. So like any business, we, as long as we're economical, we're going to be there, and things are looking much better than they were a number of months ago.
In December, the Palin administration announced an agreement under which Flint Hills and the state would work together to ensure the facility remains in operation. One option is state ownership. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a hike near Juneau ends tragically.
The visibility was very, very low, so they had tough searching situation. It was wet, it was gnarly, it was slippery.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. And by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Mountain racers from across the world will congregate in Seward on Saturday for the 82nd running of the Mount Marathon race. The 3,022-foot, 3.1-mile race can leave even some of the most talented racers torn up, bleeding, and gasping for air. But every year, the mountain race that bills itself as the oldest in existence keeps bringing runners back. APRN's Susanna Caldwell has more.
Rain or shine, extreme heat, or bitter cold, the Mount Marathon race will still be a go, even for Brent Knight, who's going for his sixth finish.
It gets really uncomfortable on that mountain when it gets hot, because there's a lot of heat pockets and stuff within the trees that just makes that mountain a giant oven. And no one really likes that.
The Alaska Pacific University Nordic Ski Club member, who has been a perennial top 10 finisher, prefers overcast and cold during the race, but sun after the finish. While the weather won't be known until Saturday, what will be known is that 900 people will scramble up the peak. This year, 1,400 people signed up, hoping for a spot. Race director Laura Kluberton says it's not the record, but it's close.
It's pretty high. It's on a weekend, so that's usually, we get a lot of returning runners on a weekend. It was just a touch lower than last year, but last year was a record year, so we were just a touch under last year, but pretty close to last year. So good to see that the race is so popular and people want to come to Seward.
Of the new racers hoping to get in, 42 women made it out of the 208 who applied, and 36 men got in out of the 269 who vied for a spot. And for the runners who really want to get in, there's always the auction, but those slots go for as much as $1,000 each. But then there's another price, the potential for serious injury on the extreme course. The Providence Seward Medical Center makes sure to prepare. Dr. Ray Robinson says they have extra staff and supplies on hand.
Historically, there's been some pretty bad head injuries. Running down the mountain at the speeds these runners do, anybody's potentially capable of taking a big tumble, especially in the areas where there's small cliffs with loose rocks, and these could certainly result in fatal injuries. The most serious injury I guess I've dealt with was a very deep cut to a young runner's thigh that required two layers of suture to bring it together.
The doctors set up an aid tent at the bottom of the cliff where the runners descend before the final push to the finish chute. But the hospital also happens to be in very close proximity.
The emergency room itself is literally on the running course. So if you're running into town, you can literally take a left right into our ambulance bay. I've never heard of a runner going directly in there off of the course, but there's certainly that option.
But five-time champion Cedar Bourgeois from Seward isn't concerned. She's just trying to relax before she makes an attempt at her sixth consecutive title.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure, but then you just have to pipe down and kind of put it all into perspective. It is just a race, just for fun. I just have to constantly stay grounded, and that really helps my nerves. I mean, it's kind of good there's no prize money in it, because it just, you know, it's not a life or death thing. So nothing, I'm not going to be kicked out of town if I don't win.
This year, she's hoping to beat her best time, set in 2005, when she covered the steep 3-mile course in 51 minutes, 44 seconds.
Why haven't I been able to catch that yet or improve it? It just drives me batty. So, yeah, I would definitely like to get in the 51s again. Of course, my ultimate goal is to have the dream race, get in the 50s, but yeah, I'm just not quite sure if I'm there this year.
But ultimately, she's just excited to be involved in something she really cares about.
It's such an Alaskan, just unique, historical thing, and I'm so happy to be part of that and a part of history. That's the race. But in general, just being in the mountains in the sport that I just have excelled in because I love it, that's what it means to me.
The run starts off with the junior race at 9:30 a.m., the women's at 11:15, and the men's at 3. In an attempt to avoid congestion, the race will also include a wave start. In both the men and women's races, a select group of 150 runners will take off 5 minutes before the rest of the pack. In Anchorage, I'm Susanna Caldwell.
Hundreds crowded the Discovery Theater yesterday to watch Dan Sullivan become the 7th elected mayor of the municipality of Anchorage. KSKA's Len Anderson attended the ceremony and has this report.
I solemnly swear
that I will support
and defend the Constitution of the United States
and defend the Constitution of the
When Dan
United
Sullivan
States.
Took the oath of office administered by District Court Judge Stephanie Joannidis, it was against a backdrop of history. Besides his wife and daughter, 8 previous Anchorage mayors were on stage. That included his father, George Sullivan, who was the last city mayor and the first to head the unified borough and city municipality created in 1975. Mayor Dan Sullivan pointed to a common thread that ran through each of the administrations.
The one thing that you all shared in common is a deep and unwavering love for this great city of ours and a commitment to leave Anchorage better when you left office than when you started. And I share that passion, and today I renew that commitment.
According to his first speech as Anchorage's new mayor, that commitment contains 4 major goals for the new administration.
The first item, of course, is the development of a responsible budget that's conservative in its revenue estimates and controls spending. Our recent revenue projections show that this year's budget, despite the good work by Mayor Matt and the recent assembly reductions, may still be short by several million dollars. And we're going to take immediate action to control city spending. We're going to be implementing an immediate hiring freeze. We're curtailing all travel. We're going to manage our overtime more strictly. And we're going to eliminate all unnecessary expenses and positions because we have to do it.
At the same time, Mayor Sullivan asked individuals and businesses to increase charitable giving, so that in restricted municipal budgets, quote, we can continue to provide services to those who are most in need.
The second most important responsibility in government is to provide a safe community. You know, we've got a mixed blessing. You know, overall crime in Anchorage, Alaska is down, but unfortunately, violent crime is on the rise, and that's just simply unacceptable.
Sullivan said one of the best ways to fight crime is to make certain the police are being deployed for maximum efficiency.
How do we know where to put them? Well, one of the first initiatives that we're going to introduce is we're going to audit how we deploy our police department and make sure that they're in the right places at the right time. You know, we've got a great police force. They're highly trained. We've added over 80 officers over the last few years, and we need to make sure this valuable public resource is being used to its best and highest use.
Sullivan touched on 2 divisive issues currently facing the municipality, the discrimination ordinance and the Kinnick Arm Bridge. He described a conversation he had with Petra Kolar, the ambassador from the Czech Republic who recently visited the city. Sullivan said he told the ambassador some people were saying the public discussions were tearing the community apart.
Ambassador Kolar reminded me of one very, very important thing. He said the essential element of democratic freedom is the freedom to disagree. And sometimes that disagreement does get emotional, and sometimes it does get loud. But you know what? Democracy is like that.
Mayor Sullivan then added he didn't expect people to always agree with his decisions, but he did promise to keep the discussion civil and open. This is Len Anderson.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A 16-year-old Juneau boy was killed when he fell off a mountain yesterday near the Mendenhall Glacier in Juneau. Rescuers this morning reached the body of Cameron Clark at about the 3,500-foot level of Mount McGinnis, a 4,200-foot peak accessed by the popular West Glacier Trail about 15 miles from downtown Juneau. Trooper Chris Ohms says a helicopter search team located Clark's body with infrared about 9:30 last night.
There's a kind of an avalanche chute that's on the backside of Mount McGinnis. It's approximately maybe 500-600 feet below the top of the mountain.
Heavy low clouds, fog, and wet conditions prevented rescuers from retrieving the body until this morning. At 5 a.m., four Juneau Mountain Rescue climbers were airlifted to 500 feet below Clark's body, then hiked up and carried the boy down the steep, rocky slope to an area where a helicopter could land. The search for Clark began yesterday afternoon after troopers received a call from the boy's father. Clark had been hiking McGinnis with two other boys. They stopped for lunch at the top. Clark put his pack on the ground, and it rolled down the back side of the mountain. The boys told rescuers that Clark climbed down to get it but did not return. They yelled into the fog and got no response, went to look for him, and then called his father on a cell phone. Bruce Bowler of Sea Dogs was operations manager at the rescue scene.
It was an extremely difficult search. It was a highly technical search. The majority of the operation was on rope. We had the helicopter, the first of the mountain rescue folks, up to somewhere between 3,400 and 3,600 feet on a 4,300-foot mountain. And they had to up climb because of the clouds, the fog, and the visibility was very, very low. So they had a tough searching situation. It was wet. It was gnarly. It was slippery.
Bowler says no one was injured in the search. The 16-year-old had just completed his sophomore year at Thunder Mountain High School. An Alaska lawmaker is questioning the ferry system's move to redirect some traffic through a Canadian port. It comes as transportation planners are asking whether Prince Rupert, British Columbia, should become the Marine Highway's southernmost stop. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Ferry officials have increased sailings in and out of Prince Rupert, about 100 miles south of Ketchikan. They increased traffic through the city after dropping some runs to Bellingham, Washington, which is much farther south. But some folks think it's a bad idea.
I've talked to people that sell tickets, and people just don't want to buy tickets to drive 800 miles to get on the ferry.
Paul Seaton is a Homer Republican representative who keeps a close eye on the state ferry system. He says ridership numbers show people are less than enthusiastic about Rupert as a port of entry. So he wrote the state's Marine Transportation Advisory Board asking that it consider the move.
There's just been a continuous push for several administrations to make Prince Rupert into the feeder for Southeastern, and it hasn't worked. And I just want to make sure that everybody is looking at all the issues and whether there has been success or failure in that regard and whether there is potential with having people do that.
Seaton is particularly concerned because the Marine Highway wants to purchase and upgrade Rupert's city-owned ferry terminal. Lawmakers have authorized $7.5 million, though no money has been appropriated. And state officials say purchase or a long-term lease could cost far more. The advisory board discussed the issue at its June meeting. Ferry chief Jim Beadle says there's no question Rupert's sailings are less than full, but he says they're getting more use.
The ridership started to increase last year without a lot of marketing, you know, targeting that route. This year, we're focusing a little more time and effort on it, and we think we're going to see results.
He says Rupert is an important part of the ferry system's future, as is Bellingham, and shifting some sailings to the Canadian port allows more service in southeast waters.
If we were to take that Rupert vessel and say, okay, you're going to go to Bellingham now, you're going to take frequency away from every town in southeast Alaska that was served by that Prince Rupert vessel. You're going to cut it in half.
The system wants to take over Rupert's terminal because the city no longer wants to maintain the aging facility. Dockings were interrupted last year for repairs, which did not fix all of the problems. The Rupert debate comes as transportation planners consider the future of the region's road and ferry routes. One proposal for an updated Southeast Alaska transportation plan would cut all sailings to Bellingham. State planner Andy Hughes says that route parallels mainland highways as well as British Columbia ferry runs.
Those services are at no cost to the state of Alaska. They're maintained by the Canadian government, and the province subsidizes BC ferries. So one of our alternatives proposes to redirect those resources that we spend on that run beyond Prince Rupert to services within Southeast Alaska.
The proposal is one of several alternatives drawn up in a preliminary plan for the region, and Hughes says while it would save money, no one's decided it's the right thing to do. Incoming Marine Transportation Advisory Board Chairman Mike Korsmo says people depend on the ferry connection to Washington State. He's also concerned that the proposal could eliminate most sailings across the Gulf of Alaska.
I think they're very, popular, at least, especially the Bellingham run for the people coming up, military families coming up to get north and a way to get, through the system without driving on the highway and crossing borders. But I think there's a lot of issues, and I think there's a lot of for the vessel running out of Bellingham.
The state is taking public input on its road and ferry plans through the end of July. Comments can be submitted through the Southeast Alaska Transportation Plan website. In Juneau, this is Ed Schoenfeld.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Rosemarie Alexander and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Susanna Caldwell reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/CEM.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others claiming the Society of Jesus, Oregon Providence, has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus, Oregon Providence. The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN, covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.